Hello, I'm Rob Caleb here at the American College of Cardiology in San Francisco. This is another episode of our Life and Times of Cardiologists that we've been doing for a while now, where we interview people that have made a big difference in the field of cardiology, hoping to inspire young people and provide some colorful background to the history of why things have happened the way they have. And I'm really delighted to have Doug Weaver with me today. Doug and I go back a long ways.
We do.
Doug, you're a New Englander, right?
I grew up in Maine, a little tiny town, 600 people.
I didn't know anybody ever left Maine if they grew up there.
No, there's several. All I knew is when I was growing up is I wanted to leave. And I don't know. I just had this desire to go beyond where I was, even as a young kid, you know? And I mean, and I had a great time as a kid. I grew up on the coast of Maine, went out and had my own lobster traps and dug clams, and you know. But I excelled in school, and my teachers kept pushing on me.
What did your parents do for a living?
My dad was a town manager. He did several jobs, actually. I don't remember when I was very young, but he worked for the IRS when he was a young man. So he taught me accounting as I was a kid, helping him with his income taxes for other people, because he did that after he stopped. And then he was a salesman. He sold commercial stuff to large schools and, you know, and large organizations. He would sell canned goods and all this sort of things from as a distributor. And I think that's where the sales part came from. And then he was a town manager, different towns in Maine. And he was a relationship builder, and I think I got some of that from him. My mother actually died when I was about 11 or 12 years old. And she was like a... There's a home in Castine, Maine, which is where I grew up, and it's the oldest town. It's the oldest home in the town. It's called the Perkins House, and Captain John Perkins started just above the Cape in Massachusetts, and kind of founded along the coast, going up in that area. So there are two or three Perkins houses that he occupied, and she would tell me stories because this town had a Revolutionary War fort in it. And the town actually was under four different flags at different times. And she said there was a dungeon in the in the cellar of the home. And there was a tunnel from this Revolutionary War fort, which was British. It wasn't an American fort. It was a British fort, where they could escape to the water if necessary. Ah. And so... But it's kind of interesting. I have one sister, Rob, and... we both went into healthcare, and I don't know if it wasn't her illness that she had for a few years.
That must have been really traumatic. That's a tough age to lose a mother. What happened?
She had a lymphoma, essentially, and was sick for, I would say, 4 or 5 years, and so we dealt with her disability. My dad kind of assumed two roles of mother and father during that time. And so it made us close, but I don't know. I moved on afterwards, you know. And
so you went on to a small high school or what?
The first high school I went to in Castine, it was a one-room school.
Oh, come on.
No, it was a one-room school. And, I mean, from grades 7 to 12, we're in this one room. And then you'd go to other little rooms to learn your Latin and calculus and so on.
Latin?
Yes, took Latin. And then...
I thought only my wife had taken Latin.
I know. And then we went to a regional high school, which was much larger. And I graduated in a class of about 125.
So you could actually have sports teams in that
school. Yeah, you could actually have sports
teams. But the one-room school, did you have like a sports team?
I was on the basketball team.
So how many players did you have?
Well, I think that that probably took most of us to make a team. But we had a very good time.
And in a one-room school, does that mean there was one teacher? Or were
no, there were several teachers. But we kind of had one study room and then these other small rooms. I think I was only there for a year or so before the regional high school popped up, and I went there.
And where'd you go to college?
I went to the University of Maine in Orono, Maine, and I met my first mentor that made a big difference in my life. His name is William Vallou, and at the time he was a zoologist and had just joined the faculty from Rutgers. And he was my advisor. He was assigned to be my advisor. So my first semester in college, I got all A's except for English composition. I got a C. So I march into his office, and he comes and he says, "Doug, what do you want to do with your life?" And I'm thinking, oh, my God, it's a C. I think, sir, I might want to be a dentist. And he went, "No." Just like that. He says, "You're too smart to be a dentist." He says, "You're going to be a doctor." And I said, "Okay." And
I hope no dentist will watch this.
I know. I hope they don't watch.
But that's what he said. It's not your attribution.
That's what he said. And he said, "I'm going to get you out of that English class because it's pulling your point average down." He says, "We'll get you into the honors program." He says, "By definition, they won't give you less than a B." And sure enough, that's what he did. And he was so he really made a difference in my life. And interestingly enough, maybe about 10 years ago, I decided to write to him because I'd never told him that he'd made a huge difference in my life. So it was around Christmas time, and you know how it gets quiet around the office. So I just sent him this letter. I said, "You know, Dr. Vallou, I just wanted you to know that he made a real big difference in my life." And then I sent him my CV and biblio, so he could kind of see what I'd done my whole life, you know. I got a letter back like in 5 days. "Dear Doug, so happy to hear from you. I've trained this many doctors, this many PhDs, this many scientists." And so he was really proud of the impact that he made on people. And at the end of the letter, it said, "By the way, there's a mistake on your bibliography." and
that's a real mentor.
I know. And so it turned out that I had worked in his lab, and we had published a paper together. And that would be my first citation, and I'd omitted it on it. So he gave me the citation.
That is fantastic.
Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
Amazing.
So English class composition, you brought that up.
Yep.
At the time, you were going, that was probably an intense, didn't you have, like, you wrote something, and then the professor would actually go over it with you?
Oh, yeah. You know, it was tough. And now I actually think I'm a really great writer, but I certainly didn't reflect when I was in college.
I just remember my freshman class was every Saturday morning I'd have to go in and face this English professor who would rip everything I wrote
completely
to shreds.
Yeah, right.
But I think is the way you learn. It's probably good for you.
I think it is, too.
So you went on then through, did you know you wanted to be a doctor after your mentor said, do it?
Yep, I just kept on the track. It was kind of like typical cardiologist, you get it in the radar screen, you stay targeted on it. I went there, and then I went to a medical school at Tufts in Boston. And that was a good experience. I worked my way through college and through medical school.
What kind of jobs did you do?
You know, I did everything. I had in college, I had a lawn mowing service. I hired other kids to do lawns and ran that business. And I was a bartender at some summer theaters. I did a lot of different things.
Now that fits that you were running the lawnmower franchise. You were not necessarily doing the lawn cutting.
No, I wasn't doing the cutting. I was just taking a commission off of all these things. But in medical school, the last years, actually we were encouraged to do externships. What you might think you wanted to do. So I actually came out here to San Francisco because I thought I wanted to be a trauma surgeon. And I spent 3 months here in San Francisco.
At the Mission Emergency Room.
You got it.
What an experience.
Unbelievable experience.
What years were those?
This would have been around 73, 74. And had a great experience, but I'd taken another rotation just before coming out here at Georgetown. And this was at the time of Proctor Harvey and Perloff. That was an unbelievable experience in cardiology. And So then I was kind of torn. Do I want to do trauma surgery? Do I want to do cardiology? And I say this because, you know, I've worked with so many young people, and you talk with residents and students, and I always kind of knew what I wanted to do, and they don't. Many don't, you know, and I feel for them when they don't, because I kind of had a target. Anyway, I did my trauma surgery here, and I talked with the chair of surgery, and he said, I did a good job, and he said, Doug, if you want to come here to my internship next year, I guarantee you've got a slot. And so I talked to him. I said, you know, sir, I'm kind of a little torn. I've taken this cardiology rotation, and I wondered if I shouldn't do a medicine internship and then make up my mind whether I want to do surgery. And being a typical surgeon, he said, if you want to come here next year, I guarantee you a slot. If you don't come here next year, you'll never get in this program. So I went on. My roommate in medical school is also a cardiologist.
Who's that?
His name is Ed Palank, and he stayed at Tufts and then went into practice in New Hampshire. I actually just saw him after, I hadn't seen him for about 15 years. I saw him about 2 weeks ago in Florida, where he's currently living and practicing a little bit. And so I was here, and he was looking at cardiology and internal medicine programs. So I called him up, and I said, I don't know what I want to do yet. He said, well, I'm going to stay at Tufts and do my internal medicine there when we finish. He said, but I just went up to the University of Washington, and I think you'd really like that program. But I was busy as hell with this rotation on trauma, you know? I mean, you worked every day, every night. And so I called up the program director, and I said, how important is it for me to interview for the position? And he said, it doesn't make any difference at all. We don't count the interview.
Really?
We only count your letters and your grades.
Wow.
And so I never went to see the place, and I ranked it number one. And so that following June, off I went to Seattle to do my internal.
Well, you must have done really well in medical school then.
I did.
Because
well.
That was a really hard program to get into, as I remember.
Yeah, no, it was hard.
You had Peter Storff and...
Yep, Peter Storff. And he made an impact on me in that this was at the time of... kind of the end of the Vietnam War, and about 3 months into the internship, Dr. Peterstoff called all the interns into the conference room, and he said, how many of you have deferments? And maybe a third of the class put their hands up that they'd had a deferment. He said, for those of you who don't have a deferment, if you don't have one in the next 30 days, you're out of the program.
Wow.
So I signed this piece of paper and continued on in my studies, and I'd been deferred all the way through cardiology training. And then...
Why did he do it that way?
He didn't want to lose any of his interns, you know, at the time of draft and everything else was going on. Well, the war had ended, and at the end of my training... my draft number was like, I don't know, 345 or something like that. And I got this call from some lieutenant. He said, you remember that paper you signed about 7 or 8 years ago? And I said, yeah. He said, well, we don't have any doctors anymore. You know, you're going to have to come into the military.
Gosh.
During the time of my cardiology training, my second mentor in my life that made a big difference was Leonard Cobb, who had worked with pre-hospital EMS.
Yeah, what an amazing impact he had on the world.
Amazing. And so I had a faculty position coming up at the University of Washington that I had to let go to go into the service. And my former roommate, Ed, had been, same thing had happened to him a year earlier. He'd only done two-year program instead of a three-year program, so he'd gone in a year earlier. And he said, you're not going to get in any of the teaching hospitals, Doug. They only go to the people who've trained in the military. He said, there's only one place that really practices cardiology, and that's in Germany, Landstuhl, Germany. It's still a site, you know, for people outside. And he said, so call so-and-so, tell him this, you want to go to Landstuhl. And so that's where I ended up going. There were five cardiologists. We had a cath lab. We had a pediatric cardiologist. I'm actually a much better clinician because of that experience. But I was there for 3 years. And then came back on the faculty at the University of Washington.
So Peter Storff lined it up for years in advance to get a military experience.
Yeah, he did. He lined it up.
Now, your time with Leonard Cobb, didn't you all do something at the World's Fair or something?
Yeah, we did. I got involved in a couple of things. And this is actually when I came back. I was really really interested in looking at evaluating the efficacy of a lot of stuff that we did in pre-hospital care. As you know, people gave epinephrine. There was no data that epinephrine made any difference. And so I wanted to do some clinical trials. Now, Leonard Cobb, he'd been more of he did more epidemiology. He looked at why sudden death occurred. And so during my fellowship, I'd written papers on the angiographic findings in survivors, the Holter findings, and the descriptive stuff on this. And when I came back on the faculty, I started to get involved with looking at automatic defibrillators, the development of automatic defibrillators. And I worked with an engineer on upper campus, actually a mechanical engineer who did sound recognition stuff. And so we were doing FFTs on waveforms, trying to make an algorithm for VF detection, which we did, published. And then at the same time, some companies were starting to look at developments of automatic defibrillators. And so I got really involved in that and helping them. And then we decided we have to test them in places. So we tested it in the EMS setting first in Seattle and showed that they could be done and it was effective. And then I wanted to try it in public places. And I've always thought sometimes I'm too far ahead of my time, you know, because it's taken like 20 years later before this stuff catches on. So I was giving grand rounds at the University of British Columbia, and it was the time of the World's Fair there, which was in the late 80s. And I was walking around afterwards downtown, and I saw they were going to do the World's Fair. I said, this would be the place to do it. And so I spent a month or so figuring out who was running the place, and it was going to happen in a couple of years. And I then convinced them to test this concept. Told them there'll be some deaths. You know, we might be able to prevent the deaths. And then I convinced Physio Control, who was making the first of these devices, to give us 30 devices to test them on the fairgrounds to see if they work. And it turned out that when the World's Fair was in operation during the day, it was the second biggest city in British Columbia. So it had its own 911 system, own first response system, because the city couldn't handle that, you know? So
we had control of that.
We designed it together, you know? And it meant that every employee was learned how to dial 911 and when to dial 911. And then security was all over the place, because during the day, security mainly was crowd control and telling people where to go and this sort of thing. And so we located these devices all over the fairgrounds, and then security would respond if there was a 911 call, apply the device, and defibrillate if the things told them to defibrillate. And at the same time, we'd activate the Vancouver EMS system. So we had six deaths, six sudden deaths during that time. Five of them were ventricular fibrillation. They all were awake by the time they got to the hospital.
Wow.
Amazing, you know?
That must have been amazing then, especially because...
No, it was amazing. And we had one person who unfortunately went into one of the expo theaters and the lights went down and the lights come up and one person doesn't get up. So they weren't discovered, you know, in time and they died. But it proved to us that the concept was a valid one, and it could work.
And a lot happened after that. So you, also at the same time, you had this interesting thrombolysis group that Ward Kennedy was leading.
My third mentor was Ward.
What was Ward? I mean, Ward's an interesting guy.
And he was, he made a wonderful impact in my life. And I got to witness kind of the tail end of intracoronary thrombolysis when I was a fellow. And then the intravenous thrombolysis trials, the Western Washington trials that were ongoing. And then, Ward was more of a clinical trialist than Leonard was. So he helped me in that. And as well, he was just a wonderful person. And he actually got me involved in the ACC. I mean, Ward was a former president of the ACC. And I got to chair one of these scientific sessions during his presidency, which was a great experience. So, three big people that made a huge difference in my life were those.
So you're on the faculty at University of Washington. You were sort of working in both areas and started a political career as a ACC politician, and then you became chief of the division, or what was your ultimate role in
at the University of Washington?
Yeah,
I became assistant medical director of the hospital. Mm-hmm. Got involved in some administration there, and I was kind of number two in the division, and it looked like I was going to be number two for a while. So I decided I need to look somewhere else, and so I started looking at other positions. The other interesting thing that had happened is my wife died when my son, John, was 8 years old. It was kind of like what happened to me was happening to him.
Happened to your son.
Happened to my son. And it taught me an awful lot, Rob. There were some things I thought my dad did wrong for my sister and I. So you got to, like, try him again, you know, and see if you could do a better job at it. And I'll never forget this one thing. It was actually the day of the funeral of John's mother, my wife. And I went in to his bedroom, and I sat on his bed, and I said, "John, I want you to let you know that things are going to be okay." And he looked at me and said, "Dad, you're okay, aren't you? You lost your mother. Why won't I be okay?" I was thinking, God, how can a kid that's 8 years old say stuff like this, you know? But it wasn't, I mean, my career was going like this, and I was a single parent, and it was a wild time there for several years. But, I mean, I have an unbelievable relationship with him because of that.
I've had fun following that with you. What happened with your wife?
She developed a very aggressive multiple sclerosis shortly after John was born, and 6 or 7 years later she was dead from multiple sclerosis, totally disabled.
Wow.
And it's interesting to see my son. He's so empathetic and compassionate to other people, you know. It made an impact on him.
So you were doing well. You had some family issues to take care of, and you did. And I got to know you then. We were working together.
Yeah, we were working together.
I used to fly out to Seattle, and we would convene and look at data. That was a tremendous amount of fun. And I actually remember you as a pretty good housekeeper. You had a...
I remember the first time you came to...
You could cook.
I remember the first time you came to my house. It's about 10 o'clock at night. Rob comes, he says, "Do you have any money to pay the cab?" You remember that?
Yeah, I had no cash. It was typical for me.
Yeah, and you said, "I've got a crazy cab driver." And he drove with his knee all the way to the house.
That was true. I actually remember that cab trip. It was frightening. But we both survived it. And then you ended up, of all places, in Detroit.
Yep. I mean, I was looking for a chief's job. And... I learned about this position at Henry Ford. I was looking also at the University of British Columbia at the time. And I met the people at Henry Ford. I didn't know a lot about it at the time. And found that the core values were the same as mine were, you know. People were education, research, doing the right thing for people. And So I made the move, and I'm one of the few people that ever left Seattle. Most people don't, but I have no regrets at all. It's been a very, very good experience.
Now, in your time there, you've done a lot of interesting things. It's not time to go through them all, but obviously your ACC experience was fantastic. You were president of the ACC.
Right.
Looking back, what do you see as your main accomplishment with the ACC?
There's a few things that I really am proud of, and one of them is the ACC has sort of been waffling about what its relationship should be with international members. And we really pushed forward that year to embrace internationals, that we should have a relationship with other international societies and people who wanted to be involved in the ACC. So I think that was one accomplishment. We looked at our annual meeting. God, you always have to look at your annual meeting, you know. And I've always had an interest in the annual meeting, and as you know, it's evolving. Doctors don't have as much time to come to do this, and so we did a lot of tweaks to the annual meeting at the time, make it a little more electronic than what it had been in the past. It's come a long way since that time. I wanted to get maintenance of certification done at the meeting. We started maintenance of certification for the first time at the meeting because I thought that was a real value driver for the docs who come here. So those are some of the things.
Now, what does the ACC need to do now?
It's an interesting question. I think the real opportunities for the ACC, the international thing is growing dramatically. So what can we accomplish on a global level that's relevant? Can't do the same thing for everybody. And so we have to focus and try to make an impact in those areas. I think the other area is I really like the things we're doing with post-market approval studies and the registries. I'm on the registry management board. I love the registry management board and what's going on there. As you know, David Holmes was really great this past year in getting the transcatheter registry up with the surgeons. And I just think there's so much opportunity in post-market registry information about devices. You and I have talked about this before.
Yeah.
You know, we have such poor data the way it's given to the FDA right now. And so one of the real value of registries is to look at devices and to look at them in a longitudinal way in much more general practice. And hopefully capture enough data that's meaningful so that you know where you should be going, you know. And so I think there's a real opportunity there for us.
Now, what about the professional status of cardiologists? The incomes are dropping.
Yep, tough times.
We're becoming employees.
Yep. So
those of us that work for universities have sort of
we've always been
there.
But, right.
But
poorly paid and employees. But this is a real era of change. There's no doubt about it, you know, and you can't shrug it off, I don't think. We're seeing groups come together, and I mean, the one thing that cardiologists will all buy into, and if it's good for patients, that's an easy one, right? It's when you get into the business of medicine that it becomes more difficult, and I think we're going to be in the middle of that radar screen, you know, for the next few years. In a time of declining incomes.
Now, you are in the middle of one of the most potent managed organizations in the country in terms of healthcare, and just in the midst of, is it a merger or an acquisition with Beaumont?
No, it's a true merger with Beaumont. Really looking forward to it. Two great organizations in Southeast Michigan. We don't reach beyond Southeast Michigan currently. We don't overlap a lot either, you know, and I think that it's going to be a real opportunity. I mean, we have differences, obviously, but this is a time where I don't think you can be small anymore, you know. There's as reimbursement goes down, you've got to look at ways to control expenses. as I've always said, you can influence revenues, but you can control expenses, you know. And if we're going to provide the amount of care we do to the kinds of people, because we try to apply it to all, and there are certainly many needing people in the Detroit area, as you well know, in the city of Detroit itself, whereas there's a lot of wealth in the suburbs. I think this provides us a way to control some of our expenses and be able to move forward.
How many cardiologists altogether will there be in the combined organization?
That's a good question. We have about 40, and there's probably 70 or 80, you know, at Beaumont. I mean, Henry Ford is all one medical group, and Beaumont's a mixture of some people employed and some people in private practice.
It's going to be a big group.
Building relationships. And I mean, we have 40 in our main hospital. We have another 50 in our other hospitals. And so we have five hospitals, and Beaumont has three. So it'll be eight hospitals.
And the combined revenue of the two
about
institutions?
Probably about $6.5 billion.
It's a big business.
Big business.
It always strikes me as funny when we talk about the medical products industry, like that's industry.
Right.
The big industry, I think, now is healthcare delivery.
Yeah.
So, Doug, just a couple of things to finish up on. You know, we talked a little about politics, but what about your career as a real politician?
As a real politician?
Well, I understand you went down to defeat.
I went down to defeat. So a year ago last November, I decided I wanted to run for city commission. I live in a wonderful little city called Birmingham, which is northwest of Detroit, city of about 20,000 people. And we were still reeling a bit from the recession at that time. And I just wondered if I could do better than the current commissioners. So the city commission consists of seven people. There were four who ran as incumbents. There were another five of us who ran for those four positions. I learned an awful lot. I know a lot about my city right now. I still follow it very carefully. I learned how to run for the office as well. And I lost by 300 votes, which in retrospect, I think I could have figured out a way to do it the second time around.
Well, is your career over, or are you going to run again?
I don't know.
Or are you willing to say?
I have to decide by this summer.
It could be right here on this interview.
I know. So those other commissioners could be watching right now, but I haven't made up my mind. I've been so busy right now with what I'm doing in the integration of our heart and vascular physicians and staff among all of our hospitals.
You must go to a lot of meetings.
I go to a lot of meetings.
But you enjoy that?
Yeah, I'm a relationship maker. I like making relationships. And I think you can get a lot done once people trust you, and you learn what their needs and wants are, and so I enjoy that a lot. And as you say, if you're doing this with doctors, you're doing it before 7 or and after 6, you know. So I go to a lot of meetings.
And what about your personal life now? I know you've relayed you've been through you know, this really interesting thing with yourself and your son, sort of recapitulating.
Yep. Well, my other half, Judy, has just been wonderful. He's been in my life for 10 years now. And my son is getting his MBA in Denver, and she has a son who lives in Denver as well, as well as a grandchild there. So it's made for a very full life. And she's just been a... She's a wonderful lady. She's just been so perfect for me. So that helps me a lot. And then my other passion, of course, is flying airplanes. That's my other relief. But I've really enjoyed that as well.
How many hours a week are you flying now?
I try to fly both Saturday and Sunday. I mean, Judy's so understanding. I'll get up at 6:30 in the morning and say, I'll see you, you know, and I'll go out and fly with three or four students till 4:30 in the afternoon, and do the same thing on Sunday. And When I learned to fly, I learned quickly that if you don't do this a lot, it's dangerous. And then if you teach it, you're usually better at it than if you don't.
That makes sense.
Doesn't it? As well as the, it's different than teaching medicine. Maybe not so for interventionalists, but it's a one-on-one thing. And so, and you're working with someone who's under a lot of stress. So they, you learn a lot about them. They learn a lot about you. Don't do that. You know, yeah. Don't ever do that again.
It does sound a little like an intensive care unit,
yeah,
though, where when you're supervising an intern there, you want it, they need to do it.
Yes,
but you got to watch
them. You got to watch them carefully, right? And I've enjoyed it.
And of course, golf. We have a mutual toiling effort with golf.
We do. Once a year, Rob and I and 10 others go somewhere. We tend to go all over the United States trying different courses. And for 3 or 4 days, hit a lot of golf balls, drink a lot of wine, eat a lot of food, and have a wonderful camaraderie.
We've been lucky, Doug.
And yeah, we have.
I guess the last question is, you still see a lot of young trainees. And
yes.
If you were starting out in cardiology today,
yep.
What would be the hot area that you would pick to go into?
That's a very good question. Starting out in cardiology. I still think that the opportunities are in academic medicine and in clinical research. I try to mentor people in that direction. It's been so professionally rewarding for me and for you. It's sometimes not as quickly as gratifying because you don't get the ego gratification every patient that you see. But on the other hand, you can make differences that have a huge impact on the way medicine is practiced.
As you've certainly done, both with the emergency care and with care of heart attacks, and now I'd call it the business world of medicine.
Yep.
We need good people there. Well, thanks for taking the time.
No,
this has been great.
Thank you for including me.
As always, I've learned a lot with you, and I'm sure that many people will take away good messages from this interview.